Before we introduce our guest for today, I want to tell you about some of the content of this week's VetVault 321 newsletter. If you haven't heard about this, it's a weekly newsletter where I share three clinical light bulb moments that I've learned from making the clinical podcasts, two other non-vetty things that resonated with me that week, and then one thing to think about, which is like a mini blog post about something that I'm mulling over. Could be vet-related, but mostly it's just about life. We've just moved the newsletter to a new platform that allows you to go and read it without signing up for anything, like a blog, including browsing the archives of older posts. Or you can sign up for free, like a traditional newsletter, and you'll get each week's post in your email inbox. So the thing I want to highlight from this week's three clinical pearls is from a yet-to-be-released episode with critical care specialist Dr. Corin Boyd about new data that shows that a ketamine bolus can help control those intractable seizure cases where you throw all of the drugs at the patient without much luck. You know the ones. Now, I have to underline that using ketamine early on during a seizure can actually make things worse, but later on in the process, it can be the magical ingredient that you've been looking for. There's quite a bit to this, so if you want the doses and the exact when and how to use it, go and check out this week's newsletter. That's the 27th of October, 2023, or better yet, subscribe to our clinical podcast so you can listen to the full discussion, which is a total masterclass on the step-by-step process of stabilizing the status epilepticus patient. Subscription will also give you access to the full show notes, so you can use it as a reference later on when you do get that seizure case and you go, what did Corin say again about this? Okay, back to our episode. We have a lot to cover. And the reason we have so much to cover is because this episode is actually made up from three separate recordings with Dr. Jane Heller. Our first meeting and the first 20-odd minutes or so of this episode was recorded last year, live and in person at Vet Expo 2022, where Dr. Jane joined Gerardo and I on the pink couch to talk about what it's like to be a veterinary epidemiologist and to tell us more about her work in the antimicrobial resistance space. But I knew that we were leaving some gold on the table on that day. So Jane joined me for a part two earlier this year to give us an update on what's happening in the antibiotic space and also to talk about her work at James Cook University in student well-being. Except halfway through that interview, technology let us down and I lost half of the recording into the ether. So we caught up again a few weeks ago, third time lucky, and I finally managed to stitch it all together into one beautiful Frankenstein of an episode where we cover a wide range of topics. But first, let me officially introduce our guest. Dr. Jane Heller is the epitome of a multifaceted vet career. She's a veterinary epidemiologist with an interest in infectious disease epidemiology, with particular reference to antimicrobial resistance and the potential for zoonotic transfer of pathogens between animals and humans. Jane's early career consisted of a couple of years in private practice and at the University of Sydney. She went on to complete her training in veterinary epidemiology and public health through a PhD and a residency at the University of Glasgow, and in 2009, Jane took up a faculty position at Charles Sturt University, where she progressed to work as an associate professor in veterinary epidemiology and public health, a position she still holds as a part-time appointment. In addition to her teaching, writing, and research, Jane also implemented a wellness program for the undergraduate veterinary students and has a deep interest in supporting student and veterinary mental health. Outside of her role at the university, she's also the founder and director of Heller Consulting, her private consulting business, where she gets to utilize all of her skills for the benefit of animals and humans. In this conversation, or should I say these conversations, we cover why epidemiology doesn't suck nearly as much as you might think it does, and what a career as an epidemiologist might look like. Jane tells us about the work of the AMR Vet Collective, a not-for-profit that she co-founded that informs and educates around responsible antibiotic usage. She shares some great resources to help you achieve better antimicrobial stewardship without making your work life harder or compromising outcomes for your patients. Part three is all about affecting behavior change, whether it is around how vets use antibiotics or getting vet students and veterinary teams to care about their well-being. Jane also shares openly about how her work in the space challenged her personally and what she learned from these challenges. Now, if you are not and have no interest in becoming an epidemiologist, then you could skip to about the 10-minute mark where we start talking about how we're thinking differently about antibiotic usage. And this bit, I would urge you not to skip. It's really essential listening for anyone with a license and a reason to prescribe antibiotics, which I'm assuming is you. At around the 40-minute mark, we pivot to talking about how we can influence behavior change in a group, which leads into the conversation about student well-being, which in turn is a really lovely framework for creating systems that support well-being in the real world without, and this is important, putting your own well-being at risk, like in a vet business. So if you are in a position of trying to influence positive change and you're frustrated because people are not engaging and you're not getting traction, then this one is for you. Okay, please enjoy Dr. Jane Heller.
Here we are, Vet Expo Day 2, heading into the afternoon sessions, and we have Jane.
Hello.
Who's Jane?
Who's Jane?
Yeah.
So I'm Jane Heller. I am here from Wagga Wagga, sunny Wagga Wagga. I'm an associate professor in veterinary epidemiology and public health at Charles Sturt University for part of my time, and I have a consulting business, Heller Consulting, for the other part of my time. And I'm here talking about the AMR Vet Collective, which is a not-for-profit that I'm one of the co-founders of.
AMR meaning?
Antimicrobial resistance.
Or that big thing.
Mm-hmm. That little thing. There, that little thing. That tiny little thing that we don't care about. No, it's kidding.
Shh, don't mention it.
Oh, shh. Yeah.
So many things we can talk about. Let's talk about we've not spoken to an epidemiologist.
Oh, you almost couldn't even say the word.
Yeah, I know. That's why I wanted you to introduce yourself, because I was going to
start. I couldn't say cannabinoids before, you know. Yeah.
There you go.
So, epidemiology.
Yes.
At uni for most vets, unless it's changed drastically, was the thing you had to get through.
Yes.
Because, like, the stumbling block to get you to the stuff that you really want to do. So epidemiology was like, I think we even had ours on a Friday afternoon. So it was like,
the worst.
To be honest, I actually kind of liked it a little bit. A little bit of me went, this is quite interesting stuff. But mostly it's just like, I was not interested at all.
It's so hard.
How do you go from, I want to be a vet, to becoming an epidemiologist?
How did I do that? It was an accident, I guess. So my full disclosure, my father is a human epidemiologist, so I didn't know what an epidemiologist was. But I, like you, sat through the lectures at vet school thinking, let's get through them so that we can go into something clinical. And I went out into clinical practice, and I really enjoyed clinical practice, and I didn't think anything about epidemiology, nothing at all, less than nothing. And then I went back and did an internship at the University of Sydney, and then...
Internship in what?
Just small animal practice. Yeah. Small animal medicine and surgery at the Camden campus.
Okay.
And then I started a master's looking at snake envenomation in dogs. Sorry, this is the long way around you how I got into epidemiology.
And then you had to do research.
I had to do some research. And then actually there were two guys that came out from the University of Glasgow that are fantastic epidemiologists and researchers, and they were really fun.
Yeah.
And they were really interesting, and I was like, I really like this. So it was based pretty much on people being fun and actually having an interest in what I was doing and being just having a really different take on things.
So that's the epidemiologist recruitment strategy.
Exactly. Yeah, they just go around the world, basically.
Yeah, you're much cooler than I thought an epidemiologist would be. I'm not going to stop saying that word.
Look, I would say that's a compliment, but I know it's not. Like, that's just like one little step up.
I'm the nerd burgers down the bottom.
Exactly. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
So what does work look like for you? Or what has it? Like, let's say somebody's listening and going, oh, that sounds cool. I'm half interested.
Yeah.
But what's my working life going to look like? Okay. What are my options?
So that's an interesting question. So I'm a little bit different in the way that I got into epi than most people. Most people get into epi from being farm animal background.
Yeah, that's what I thought it was.
Yeah. Okay, and because populations with veterinary science often are seen as herd populations, so herd health and herd medicine, things like that. So my background is small animals. I've never treated a large animal in my life. I did once, but anyway, that's another story probably not to go into. But so for me, population medicine and epidemiology, you know, it exists in human health. Every animal is a part of a population, and so I've come from quite a different background. So my interests when I started were very companion animals based, and so I was really interested in that. So my PhD was in a companion animal area, and I've done a lot of help with research in companion animal areas, but also sort of branched out into other animals as well. So for me, what my work looks like, because I'm an academic, or I have been an academic and I'm still doing some academic work, it's very much research-based. So looking at researching different issues in populations, and that can look like any sort of issue really needs an epidemiological approach at some level.
Yeah.
But also, I really like supporting clinicians to use epidemiology in their everyday life as well. So every time you do a clinical test, when you interpret it, you're using epi skills, and whether you think you are or not, and some people are doing it overtly and they're thinking, oh, the sensitivity or the specificity of this test is X or Y, yeah, and the predictive value is whatever. But really all that is saying is it's putting words to what people do, what experienced vets do every day.
Yeah.
They get a test result back and they think, am I going to believe this? Or how likely is this to actually be true?
Okay.
So and then
reference ranges would even be part of.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I had no idea.
Absolutely.
In my head, that's statistics more than epidemiology.
No, because you, well, I mean, there is a statistical component, definitely. Yeah. But no, that judgment about diagnostic tests and the likelihood of them being correct is really important. You use it every day. And diagnostic tests don't have to just be PCRs or, the results of blood tests. They can be looking at an animal and seeing it's got a rough hair coat, looking at, in its mouth, and all of those different clinical signs, the presenting signs, historical information, all of that sort of
Sigmund.
Stuff. Yeah. All of that. They are all diagnostic tests, and they layer, and you interpret them as you go along, and that's part of your diagnostic process. We can put numbers to that. We absolutely, and I love to. Don't give me the opportunity, but the reality is that you don't need numbers. You can think about it in epidemiological terms and come out with a probability in your head that doesn't have a number attached to it. It's just, is this likely enough for me to call it?
Yeah.
Mm. Okay.
Yeah.
So that's all epi.
So I could put
that's a shift
emergency
for me.
Veterinarian epidemiologist.
You could, absolutely.
Add significant numbers of letters on my name. It's got to be at least 15 letters in that word.
That
I can't pronounce.
So if I want to go down the epidemiology pathway as a career, so beyond academia and research, what are the applications when you do other stuff now? What's the sort of work that you're going to do?
The sort of work that you do, a lot of people who work in government have epi backgrounds, thinking about disease outbreaks, how to approach them, how to prevent them, what to do. I mean, and, we're in a great time for epidemiologists. I hate to say it, but, there are a lot of diseases on our doorstep. And, there's a whole load of people who are working very hard across all of the wonderful government agencies to try to make sure that they stay out. And if we are unlucky enough to get an incursion, to actually figure out what we need to do to try to make it as small as possible.
So is it fun?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, it's really fun.
I kind of wish sometimes that we had a podcast like this when I was a student or a new grad, because I feel like there's a whole world of stuff that people do that I didn't, it wasn't even on my radar to talk about it. And a lot of it I go, that actually does sound pretty cool. But I had all these preconceived ideas about stuff that are just completely unfounded and uninformed.
But you're right, like, you don't get exposed to these things until you're a graduate.
Yeah.
A lot of the time. I mean, you are, because you're taught by a lot of people. Yeah. But really, it's and like I said, the reason I went into it was because I met these guys that were really cool and were doing great things.
And on the flip side, you have an epi lecturer who's really drab and boring. Yeah. And like,
I know. Like me, no CSU grads are doing epi. No. But it's true. It's true.
Well, all righty. MR.
MR.
Antibiotic microbial resistance.
Yeah, how'd that all happen?
Yep.
Does that tie in? Did that happen because of your job?
Career? Yeah, it did. I did my PhD in antimicrobial resistance. I was really interested in it. And I did a PhD. I was over in Glasgow because I'd followed these guys that were really cool over to Glasgow. And, I was interested in antimicrobial resistance. I knew it was an issue. I wanted to do something about it. I did my PhD in it, in an area in it, and just got worried about it, I guess, and so wanted to do some work in that space.
Mm.
So it's a tricky space to work in. And we were speaking before, and I think you said something that it's something that I think about often, and it's really true. It's really like climate change. It's a thing that we know is going to be a really big issue. It is a little bit of an issue. Well, it is an issue. It's certainly a big issue in some areas. It's only going to get bigger.
Yeah.
But actually, that immediate threat is quite minimal to individuals. And so it's really hard. And
it's hard to get action on an individual basis.
It's really hard. And one of the things that I really love is communication and communicating science and thinking about how to communicate. And so I think that's part of the reason that my interest was piqued in this area as well, because it's an area that's – it's a big area – but people aren't engaged with it. And so that's a challenge, right? It's interesting and important.
Yeah. Yeah, we talked about it before. The psychology of getting people to care about it is hard, because it is a distant problem. It can sound like a bit of a dry problem, like a bit of a – and there's a your first instinct is almost, well, this is just going to make my everyday life even harder. Because I have all these decisions that I have to make around my patients.
Yeah, and is it really real?
And is it really real? Is it just
is it going to have to do with this one patient that I give this drug to and so forth?
Let's give it some perspective in terms of real Jane knowing what she knows now versus Jane practicing clinician back when you qualified.
Yep.
What would you say to her? Would you slap her and say, "You to be
No, I would say you're doing the best that you are doing with the information that you currently have.
Okay,
the old Maya Angelou quote, but when you know better, do better. And I think that's probably the biggest thing, is that we don't know enough about it as graduates. When we start in clinical practice, there's a lot to deal with. There's a lot to deal with. And you're making decisions that are really hard decisions every day. Which type of antibiotic that you pick off the shelf, or whether you use an antibiotic, that's your easy decision, right? At the time, that seems like it's the easy decision. You're just going to do what you need to do. But the reality is that once you learn a little bit more about it, you can make more informed decisions that are better decisions. And it's really important to be able to do that. It's super important to have that capacity to actually make a decision that isn't just right for that moment where you just need to get it fixed. It's right for that moment and the next moment and the future.
And the reason, so we had the, if anybody hasn't listened to the episode we had with Riyati Scarborough on this topic and the clinical applications of it, go back and have a listen.
Please do.
It was, the resource was it amazing.
That was paradigm shifting for me.
Yeah.
Habit formation, because again, I've got 20 years of bad habits.
Yep.
Or let's say wrong thinking and not appreciating the gravity of the situation. And now suddenly going to that shelf and reaching for the antibiotics and going,
not grabbing amoxiclav.
Don't go straight for the top.
For that skin infection.
Exactly. Just thinking about it. But I think it came from understanding these, because I said to Ray at the time, in my head, it was a problem for large animal vets who treat the things that we're going to eat.
Yep.
I don't need my patients, not an issue.
Yeah,
so
really
recap for us again, why is it important for smallest vets to care about it? What's the climate change type of action that's going to happen if we do ignore it?
Yeah, I mean, it's the same as in humans. I mean, anytime we use antibiotics, we are applying selection pressure. And you know, whether it's a companion animal or any other species, it's still potentially applying selection pressure. You're still potentially selecting for resistant bacteria. Mm. When you've got resistant bacteria, it's not just the bacteria, it's the genes as well. And we're in close contact with animals.
Yeah.
So we're going to get things within the animal population, within our companion animal population, we're going to get more infections. We're going to get more difficult infections to treat. So animals are going to be sicker and sicker for longer. They're also going to have the capacity to pass on those bacteria and infections to people. That happens relatively infrequently, but it's still a potential risk. And potentially to transfer genes as well to other organisms. Super important. So, you know, if we're not interested in reducing antibiotic use in humans, which I think we'd all agree that we are, we don't want antimicrobial resistance in humans, then the same argument is there for companion species as well. I mean, they're just another population. We want them to have the benefit of reduced resistance and not having resistant organisms circulating in their population with the potential for transfer to other species as well, even if we're not eating them. Because we are cuddling them.
Yeah.
And they're eating in our kitchen often, and they're sleeping in the same bed potentially.
What's in it for me?
And, you know, okay, so let's take it down to a situation where you've got a household where you've got an immunocompromised child and you've got a companion animal who isn't sick but might be carrying a resistant bug. Now, that's a risk for that child in that setting. or for an elderly person or for someone who's on chemotherapy.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, just wow. Not even in a personal health or family health thing. The shift for me with that conversation was, what's in it for me as a veterinarian? Because mm-hmm. yep. we're talking to mm. veterinarians here. Is that it means that maybe in 10, 15, 20 years' time,
yeah.
I won't have those. I'll go to absolutely. That shelf and go, yeah. well, I have nothing.
Yep.
The way I was thinking about then, it was like, I'm sick in hospital with something. And then, like, in a small way, I contributed to the fact that I have something that
the doctors can't
that
treat.
That the doctors can't treat.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And look, let's not forget that it's really important to remember where we sit in the grand scheme yeah. of things. We're not saying that antibiotic use in humans is not an issue. It's yeah. a major issue. And it far outweighs the issue with respect to use of antibiotics in animals. Mm. Doesn't mean that we don't have an issue.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that we don't have to do something.
Or our really contribution important. Won't have an impact.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yep. So absolutely. Beyond resistance, so since having that conversation, now my ears are pricked for mm-hmm. more facts about antibiotics. And there's more to it, and it's maybe off topic, so you could say, yeah, it's true or not, but we can move on from it. But there was that conversation with Jill Madison about the data about antibiotic use in young animals and how it there's strong data in humans, and they think in animals as well, that can predispose to immune-mediated disease later in life. We go, that's – so now when I've got that 6-month-old puppy with a gastro, like, yeah, you're not having any antibiotics for a long – unless you're really sick, you're not having
– Yeah. And it makes sense, right? You're messing around with the microbiome.
Yeah. Well, that's it. And that was the next thing. I'm hearing more and more about the microbiome and the importance of it and everything it does. And girl, every time I give that antibiotic, I'm messing with that.
Yep. Absolutely. You know,
suddenly personally, if my doctor says, I'm going to put you on antibiotic, I want to say, are you sure?
Yep.
Because I have lots of little friends in my gut that I don't
know. Yeah. I'd like to keep them.
I like them. Yeah. They keep me healthy.
Yeah.
Wow. So, exactly. So the AMR itself, explain it as an organization. What's it there for? How do we engage in it? What's in it for me?
So it's called the AMR Vet Collective. Mm-hmm. And basically, the idea is that it's an independent organization, and we've just made it a not-for-profit, which is fantastic because it makes it independent. The idea is that we're there for vets to help them to connect to the fantastic resources that are around. And where there aren't resources, we sometimes try to fill the gap. Okay. There's an online learning program. That's the big ticket item because to do an online learning program, that's an investment of time.
It's commitment,
There's CPD points available with it. It's free. It's an easy, as far as online learning programs go, it's a pretty good
resource. How long
resource.
Is it? Like how much time are we talking?
So it's a 9-module program, and each of those are a couple of hours each to go through. So it's, you can dip in and out, and it covers a whole load of different things. And we've just also developed a first species-specific module, which is a poultry module, and that's not just for poultry vets. It's also for anyone in general practice who sees any sort of poultry coming in, so your backyard chook, all those types of things. So super, super useful, but you have to click on the button. You've got to register for it, right? That's a big deal. But then the other thing that we have is a website that is designed to help people to connect with all sorts of other resources that are developed by all these other wonderful groups, including the group that Ree's in Melbourne, who have the absolutely fantastic resources. So the idea is we're a collective. People can go there. They can get access to other material that is developed by other groups. They can also get access to the guidelines. So there's a lot of guidelines that are being developed all the time for antibiotic use. So we've got guidelines for companion species. We've got guidelines, what else have we got? We've got a mental blank. We've got sheep. We've got cattle. We've got pigs. And they're all housed on different areas, but you can access them all through the AMR Vet Collective. So the idea is that it's an easy place to get to any resource that you need about antimicrobial resistance or stewardship.
Okay.
And we've got some downloadable resources for clinics as well.
Yeah, the resources are really good.
They're really good. So is it searchable? So I'm trying to think in terms of my day-to-day. So now I'm aware of this.
Yes.
I want to be better about it. It's a Sunday shift, 11 o'clock on a Sunday.
Yep.
Get the
10
the
people in the waiting room. Yep. I've got to make a decision on antibiotic for this patient now. I'm like, okay, I want to make a better decision.
Yeah. So
what
you're going to do is you're going to go to the guidelines.
The guidelines.
But you're going to get to the guidelines through the AMR Vet Collective. I mean, you might get to
the should have the guidelines printed out on the wall of the clinic.
Well, the guidelines, they're pages long. So you just probably need them bookmarked or to, I mean, it's easy just to get on through the site.
Yeah.
And, you should, they are very searchable. So you can just put in whatever and you can get to it.
Put in cat abscess. Cat abscess.
To the guidelines.
And let's just go, no.
Yeah, 100%. It will say no, yes.
What about, so the guidelines, are they regional specific to Australia?
They are Australian guidelines, yes. And there are guidelines that are in different parts of the world as well. There's some fantastic ones that have been published through Canada with really, really great content. But we always recommend that you, where you can, you use regional guidelines. Yeah. And so at the moment we've got Australian guidelines, so we're specific to Australia. It would be great if we had some other resources that help people to understand what was most common in their specific regions of Australia. That's yet to come.
Yeah.
But, yeah, our guidelines are the better guidelines to go to initially.
So the reason it's regional specific is that because the resistance patterns are determined by what's been used commonly over the decades. Yep.
And a really great example in Australia, particularly with our farm animal species, we haven't used any fluoroquinolones. So we have a very different resistance profile for our bacteria that are associated with farm animal species than they might do elsewhere in the world. So salmonella, for example, in Australia.
So better here?
Much better here.
Oh, yeah, really?
Much better here. We're very lucky. The previous decisions that have been made in Australia have stood us really well.
Is that my excuse for being ignorant? Because when we spoke to Jill Madison, who's Australian but living in the UK, and we did that episode on antibiotic choices, sensible antibiotic choices, and she's also a big... And she said something about, and you know, sort of offhand, and of course we never use Endro. And I was like, hang on, we never use Endro. Why? We use it all the time.
Yeah.
And she's like, what?
Yeah.
You don't know about it. Is that because it's a different... should it be as big an issue in Australia?
I think probably so we don't use it in farm animal species.
Okay. Yeah.
In companion animals we've probably been a little bit
slack. Yeah.
And the UK is probably a little bit ahead of us in terms of that kind of restricted kind of use and cascade system that they use and what have you. But that's not to say that when I first started in clinical practice, and I have not been clinical for a very long time now, and bearing in mind we've got some great clinical people who contribute, I'm not the clinical person, I'm the epidemiologist, but when I was first in practice, it was Plavulox and Enrofloxacin.
Yeah, yeah.
And if Plavulox didn't work, then you used it. You know, I didn't have any process going into it. And I think that's changed a lot. We've still got a long way to go, but I do think that it's shifting.
Qualified... But now it's cool again because when I qualified first, it was sulfurs.
Yes.
Because Clavulox was a new drug and that was expensive.
Yep.
So you go for the cheapies first.
Yeah.
And only for the bad ones, we go, well, now we're going to go for the expensive ones.
Yeah.
And then it was like, oh, no, that's not cool. Don't use those rubbish antibiotics. These are the norm now. And now it's going back to, those old ones.
Absolutely. The old ones are good if they're indicated, you know. And that's why the guidelines are really good because they'll let you know for the issue that you're looking at, what is useful and then what is the lowest level of importance.
Yeah.
So you can make really good informed first line decision, basically. Can I just, you asked a question about when you're in practice and you're looking for resources.
Yeah, please do.
I just want to point out that one of the big things that we're trying to do is make it easy for people to get hold of resources and also to see new resources that are coming through. And we've got, to that end, we've got a social media presence. So we've got Facebook and Instagram and also LinkedIn and Twitter, but I'm not very good at Twitter, so that's still emerging. And we're really keen for people to follow us on that so that again, that's an easy reminder that we're there.
Yeah.
And it's an easy way, again, if you can't even remember where the site is, you can remember on your social media that type in antimicrobial resistance and it will probably come up if you followed it.
What's the sort of content that you're putting on there?
What sort of content? We remind people of what we've got. So our resources, we've got a lots of shareable tiles that are aimed at clients about why we might be making changes to what we're doing with antibiotics. So the idea is that clinics can just click on and share that straight out on their clinic Facebook or Instagram page.
You mentioned the tiles, the shareable tiles for the clients, because I think that in response to that episode, it actually generated quite a lot of conversation on some of the vet social media things. I don't know if you're aware of it. People sharing it saying, you need to listen to this, and then watching the comments in there from vets going, yeah, very interesting, but no ways, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to not give an antibiotic in this scenario because I'll get in trouble if that goes wrong. Which is really, I think that's a big reason why. It's one of the big stumbling blocks.
Absolutely.
And how do you talk to the clients about it is a big thing for me. But what I'm finding in trying to be better about it, is that people are totally open to it.
Yep.
So instead of going, here's an antibiotic in case something goes wrong with this wound, yep, or that abscess or what name the disease, without discussing it with the owner, I would have just given it, yep, to cover my ass, really.
Yeah.
Now I'll go to them and say, look, this is what's wrong with the animal. This is what's going to happen to it, potentially.
Yeah.
It will probably be fine with this, this, and this without antibiotics. 2 years ago, I would have given you a course of antibiotics.
Yeah.
If you're going to feel much more comfortable if I give it, I will. But these are the reasons why. And I'll say, because I'm learning more and more throughout my career, that it's not without consequence. It's not completely harmless for your pet and for the greater picture. So if you're okay with it, I'm going to skip on the antibiotics for now.
Yeah.
If I'm wrong and that does become an issue, these are the things to look out for. Then by tomorrow, that's going to be red. It's going to be pussy, yeah, or these and these and these things. Then I want you to come back and then we'll do an antibiotic. Are you okay with that? And I've never had somebody say no.
Yeah,
never had
perfect.
A single person go, no, just rather, yep, give me the antibiotics.
Yep. Mm.
Which is astounding. That's,
so
I'm amazed with it.
That's a perfect description of delayed prescribing. And it's absolutely what we want people to do.
Okay.
And we're really keen to help people to do that. And you know, we're one of our plans is to develop some scripts for people.
Yeah.
And it's exactly
that.
What you
want.
Thank you very much. Yeah. I'm just going
to
write that down. We'll put it on the site and people can access it. But that's exactly right. I mean, it's really hard to start to change what you do. You as a vet, you get really good at what you do. And to change it and to get a new script and to use new words in familiar places is so, so hard. Mm. And, you know, for anyone who's listening to this, if there's things that you think that would be useful for yourself or for other veterinarians, we want to know about it because we want to be able to help people to make that change. Mm-hmm. And we've got the platform that we can develop things and put them on the platform that people can access. That's, you know, really important to us, is that we're doing what it is that vets need. Mm-hmm. So, you know, huge call out for people to let us know if there's something that they can see that would be useful, like conversation scripts, you know, like handouts, what they think that it might be useful to have on handouts, what they think it might be useful to have on shareable social media tiles.
Yeah.
Those types of things we're hugely open to.
That's awesome.
Cool.
That's good.
All right. Let's wrap it up there. But we'll
excellent.
Get you back
on. So
we'll
much.
Talk about more stuff, but not today.
Fantastic.
All right.
Alluding
for joining
to
us.
Amazing other topics that you'll have to listen to later.
We've got to talk about, Jane is very into student well-being, vet student well-being.
Yes.
But that's a big topic, so we'll tackle that as an official episode. Lots to say about that. But
thank you, Jane.
Join in.
Okay. Thank you. Okay.
So, Jane, part two of our discussion of our conversation, separated by how many months? About 9 months ago, we had our last chat.
Long time ago.
Sounds like much has changed for you personally. We'll get to that in a second. But let's talk about the antibiotic stuff first. It's become a thing for me through the podcast and through the interviews and the people I'm meeting. When I had that first conversation with Ree about responsible antibiotic use, that was like the road to Damascus moment almost of like, oh shit,
the aha moment.
Lots I need to learn about this, which has made me curious. And we've done a few more clinical episodes about changes in how we use antibiotic with people who do this, such as yourself, for a living. What's new for AMR since we spoke last time? Has anything changed? How's it going with the whole awareness?
Ah, okay. So new bits and pieces all the time. In terms of the AMR Vet Collective, we still mooching along, trying to get as much information out to as many people as possible. We think we've probably reached saturation with people who are interested in antimicrobial resistance. But as you well know, it's the people who haven't necessarily thought about it and been engaged in it before that are our next target audience, that are the really important group for us to speak to and to encourage to take an interest and spend a little bit of time thinking about how things could change.
Yeah, it's just getting that attention. It's just literally because, as you say, if you're not interested, if it's not on your radar of something that's important, then if you see an article or a heading or you see, oh, there's a podcast on this, you're going to go, not for me, I'm not interested, skip, I'm not going to listen.
Yeah, scrolling by.
So how do you catch them? How do you engage them? I'm sure you feel it big time. But again, since I've become interested in this, to me it's like, oh, duh, this is what the smart people are saying. This is what we should be doing. And then some people in the profession for a while, and often those are the guys who are the hardest to reach, who go, yeah, that's not good for me. And I find that, you know, they're just averse to it. And you want to go, but it's science. The science says this. You can't just go on your own opinion. You have to follow. And no, they're just like, nah, clients will complain. Do you find that?
Yeah. And I mean, there's a whole lot of social science in this. And I think that's where the next wave really is. And I think the thought about forcing people to do anything is we've given that up because it's not useful. It doesn't work. And it actually is sometimes counterproductive and detrimental. And I think really what we're wanting to do with the AMRVET Collective and one of our big aims is to come alongside people and to really help people. Because often people aren't interested because they're worried and they're vulnerable. You know, is what I've been doing wrong? And yeah, of course it will be. What everyone does all the time is wrong. And there's no shame in that. It's nothing bad about it. I just went to a course on epidemiology last week and a whole load of stuff that I've been doing for a long time is wrong. Great, I've figured out a new way and a different way. There's new stuff. Let's do it differently. And the trick is trying to help people to be open and vulnerable enough to say, okay, I actually don't know. How do I know now learn and change? And how do I find the time to do that? Because I think that's the other really big thing is how do I eke out time to actually make these changes that are difficult and not easy and not intuitive necessarily to begin with. So the main thing is the psychology and the social science around it. And I think coming alongside people is really important. How we get alongside people is the hard thing now, I think, is getting access to actually being able to access these individuals who really need some help to start thinking about change.
Yeah, time. I'm trying to think of the stumbling blocks for me and other people that I see. Time, habit. It's just a new habit that you have to learn. So even that's where I'm stuck now because I know I cerebrally know it. But as you say, on a busy clinic day, it's just so easy to do the thing that you've always done you have to interrupt yourself and go, hang on, wait, and then start cultivating those new habits of doing it and a little bit of courage because some of the things, it's a fear-based thing. It's a fear of change and then also a fear of repercussions. Go, well, it's worked for me for the last 20 years what I've done. What if this doesn't work and I start having blowback and I have issues with clients or, you know, treatment doesn't work or the animal gets sicker or something like that. So that was a big thing for me. And I find that's a big stumbling block for a lot of people is to go, well, if I don't use antibiotics like I'm used to, then my client's going to be unhappy. They're going to come back or they're going to go to the other vet and the other vet's going to say, that guy's an idiot. He should have used antibiotics or he should have used a longer course of antibiotics or something like that. So I think that's probably the biggest stumbling block. I've seen, if I don't give that cat abscess antibiotics and he goes septic, I'm going to be in trouble.
Absolutely. Never mind the fact that the chances are very, very low. I think story-based learning, and I think one of my big things that I'm very keen to do in the AMR Vet Collective when we get a little bit more funding is to collect stories and to collect case reports and case studies, not of really interesting, difficult cases about antimicrobial resistant organisms, about these really simple cases that are done so often with using antimicrobials. Your example is a perfect one, treatment of abscess. Cat-fido abscesses, really, really beautiful example. Treatment of diarrhea, surgical use of antimicrobials, those types of things. I want case after case after case where they're fine. There's no antimicrobials used or there's a change in antimicrobial usage and we get good outcomes because I think that's what's missing. When people have been doing it a certain way for a long period of time, they've got a big backlog in their mind of successful cases, and I'm going to put successful in inverted commas. So not successful long-term because we're contributing to resistance and it's not evidence-based anymore, but there's no catalogue of successful changes. And I think that that's what we can have. And I've spoken to many, many vets who have made changes like you, who have found it really difficult, but who have been really successful with it and said, you know, this is what I do now. I don't have a problem. This is how I address it. And this is what I do to mitigate any effects with clients. And another thing that you said, I'm pretty certain you mentioned it the last time we spoke, the script that you have in your head, that the way that you talk to clients about this, because everyone is a veterinarian, you have scripts that you go through and you say the same thing or a similar type of thing every day or every time you see a similar sort of case. And actually changing that script is really tricky. But having some actual words around it, and I think you put some words around it the last time we spoke, and having that in your mind and being able to call on that, I think super valuable and really empowering. So I think those types of things are good.
I'll say that script again in case this conversation was off air. I can't remember because we've chatted again. But I find this really useful because that fear of the clients being pissed off if I don't do antibiotics, I've found it completely unfounded. People are so open to it because the non-veterinarians, the human population, they're aware of antibiotics being an issue. It's in the media. It is out there. So my script goes, so let's say the cat abscess or the hemorrhagic diarrhea or all of these things that I traditionally would have just gone, oh, I'm going to go, just to be sure, we'll cover with antibiotics. I'll say to people now, 3 years ago, I would have given you antibiotics for this. That's the way I was taught, and I've done that for 20 years. But there's new information out there that says it's not actually necessary. Most cases will be absolutely fine. I'm also learning about the potential negative repercussions of antibiotics. It's not without consequence. It can have long-term effects on your pet. And people know that. They go, yeah, I'm aware of it. So then I'll say to them, what I want to do is try without antibiotics. If it develops an infection, if it is going to be an issue, these are the things that you're going to see. Your animal's going to get sicker. I give them the whole spiel of what to look out for. I'll say, if I'm wrong about this and he does need an antibiotic, within a day or so, you're going to see he's going to be worse instead of better. Then I want you, you don't even have to bring your pet back. Just come back and it's on my notes. Just pick up some antibiotics. That's straightforward. And then you're going to start him on an antibiotic. So I make it easier for them. And then I end by saying, but if you're uncomfortable, if you'd rather we'd use antibiotics, I'm not going to say no. I'm happy to do it. And I've not had a person say, oh, yes, actually, can I have the antibiotics yet? I think it's money as well. Like antibiotics costs $60, $80, $100. And if I say to them, it's probably not even necessary, they go, yeah, I don't know. I don't spend extra money. Again, I'll even say to them, if I'm on the fence, I'll say, if it's okay with you, go to your reg vet or because I do emergency or come back to us in 24 hours time and we'll recheck the temperature to pick up any early signs. And that really works. It really works. And people have no resistance. And as far as I know, I haven't had any horrible experiences. I say as far as I know because as an emergency vet, my patients go back to the regular vets. But I've not yet had a reg vet call me and say, you fucking idiot, my patient died. Why didn't you give an antibiotic?
Yeah, and there's nothing that is overriding your clinical acumen there. It's still working within your clinical acumen. We're not conversing around lack of use of antibiotics. It's changing with current evidence and understanding. And I think that script is absolutely brilliant because you're giving power to the client as well and you're telling them what to expect. And that potentially delayed prescribing as well, another absolutely brilliant and very, very valuable resource to do. And that's a really good option for people as well, is to really talk about that, to ensure that people know that they can come back if they're uncomfortable and they don't actually, you know, it's not a all or nothing phenomenon. There's a little bit of security in there for people who are trying to make a change. I think it's fabulous.
Interesting, because again, I had a clinical conversation with Prof. Steve Epstein from UC Davis, who is an emergency specialist, is into antibiotic stuff. And he did a talk at VEX couple of months ago about duration of antibiotics coming from the human medicine. Because again, that's they're leading the charge in this whole thing. The human medicine guys are ahead of us in their thinking. And just how short you need it for. So pneumonia causes in human medicine. And he's saying he's been doing the same for 2 years in his patients. 5 to 7 days of antibiotics. UTIs, the simple UTI, 3 days. 3 days of antibiotics, treat until the signs go away and then stop. And let the immune system take. That's such a paradigm shift because we were literally taught the opposite of saying full course, otherwise you're going to get resistance. And now they're saying, no, just treat until the signs go away and then stop. It's a big shift. It's hard to actually get your head around. But I had the experience recently where one of my kids got a really bad middle ear infection. Same approach, because I'm nervous now with my kids with antibiotics because we had another discussion with Prof. Jill Madison about the potential repercussions in juveniles, animals, on the immune system, on potentially predisposing them to autoimmune stuff. So now with my kids, I'm paranoid. I'm like, no, don't put them on antibiotics if you don't have to. And I was so pleased that the GP said, no, middle ear infection, mostly going to be viral. And they have found that even if it is bacterial, it resolves maybe a day earlier with antibiotics, but it resolves anyway without antibiotics. So we're not going to give antibiotics. So just to see it out there in the human world as well like that, that same approach helps me with my decision-making around it. We were talking about how there is resistance to the message, right? People stuck in their ways or go, oh, it's not relevant to me, or I've done this for 20 years and I've never had a problem. You talked about a system of thinking about changing ways of thinking.
Yeah, yep, talking about the trans-theoretical model of behavior change.
Talk us through that, please.
Yeah, so since we started the ANR Vet Collective, we have been using and relying on the trans-theoretical model of behavior change, which is pretty well known in social science and marketing circles. So we're coming to a profession that's got a really broad range of people. Okay, so they're moving from not even thinking and knowing that antimicrobial resistance is an issue or not contemplating it. So that's a pre-contemplation stage, through the contemplation stage where they kind of have an understanding, to being prepared to take action, then taking action, and then being in maintenance. So the same message is not going to fit all of those people. And so for us, it was really important to develop both resources and messages that essentially helped people to move through each of those stages. So essentially, if we're going to send out a whole load of information about prevalence of antimicrobial resistance in different disease processes, different pathogens, that'll work really well for those people who are already taking action and who are already interested in antimicrobial resistance and it's on their radar. But it will probably actually switch off people who are not at all interested, those that are in the pre-contemplation or the contemplation stage. It's too much. It's overwhelming. So for us, it was really important to be aware of that and to have those different messages that actually helped people to move through from whatever step that they're currently on to the next step, if that makes sense.
So you've got to cater for very basic messaging about, hey, there's this thing that maybe you should be aware of, where, to pique their interest to go, oh, wow, I didn't know that.
Yep.
To then saying, and I imagine on this particular topic of antimicrobial resistance, where a lot of people will go, okay, I hear you, but I'm too busy, or it's not that important, or you're making a big deal of nothing. And then, as you say, it's kind of switch off almost, going, I don't want
to. Absolutely.
That, I feel like, is almost the hardest group to go.
Oh, right, absolutely.
Now I've informed you about it, but I see that you don't really believe me, or you don't you're not taking it seriously.
Yeah.
Or again, it's almost like the climate change thing. Sometimes you just go, oh, geez, it's another thing to worry about. I'm actually going to actively disengage from this because it causes me worry and I feel overwhelmed and powerless.
Yeah, look, I think that analogy is absolutely perfect, and that's the way that I tend to think about it. And the climate change thing is just, it's perfect because with antimicrobial resistance, it's the same thing. What you do today, you can't see a tangible outcome necessarily right at this point in time. And sometimes you'll even see potentially a negative, in inverted commas, effect insofar as you get pushback from the client or it's not just a set and forget. The real outcome is long term and it's less tangible. So it's much harder to actually make those changes when you're not immediately seeing a tangible positive effect. And so I think that's a really good analogy. It's really hard. It can be really super hard. And it's not just necessarily what we're saying, it's also how we're saying it as well. It's the type of messaging that we're giving that is really important to be varied for those different steps. And again, as you can imagine, with climate change, it's a completely different message for those people who are willing and prepared to take action versus those that are still, oh, is this really an issue? And do I really need to spend time and effort and energy on it? And particularly, like you said, and in an environment where you've got, I mean, people are, vets are smashed. We know that. They're hugely busy. There's a lot of competing interests in terms of what they spend their time and effort on. And we are absolutely aware that even with the best of intentions, antimicrobial resistance and antimicrobial stewardship by its very nature is a little bit down the list. So we're just trying to help people to make it easier to bring that up the list and to make it something that people are happy and easily able to engage with.
So to make that practical, how are you doing that? Let's talk about that group of people. Is it just repeated messaging through social media or email? Like what's the plan? And the reason I'm digging into this is I feel like this conversation about changing ways of thinking can be so useful for a practice owner or for anybody who's trying to change any behavior in clinic, out of, or when we start talking about the wellness stuff as well. Same thing, you've got to change mindset.
Yeah, look, there's we've tried a few different things. Number one is getting the message to the right people. That's the first and most simple aspect of it. And again, the reality is we have a fabulous social media site, which has a whole load of things that go that we put out on that. It's links to our resources, examples of what's being done elsewhere. But the fact of the matter is, if you're in the pre-contemplation or even the contemplation stage, it's unlikely that you're going to link with that. You're not going to be following us because why would you? So access is the first issue and the first really important point. And it's actually where we've hit quite a bit of a stumbling block, because it's quite hard to access people around this, where people are not looking for it. People are not necessarily engaging in it, even if they do see it. And what we need to do is to actually go through sites and areas where people are not necessarily expecting antimicrobial resistance and stewardship. And then we have to get the messaging right when we do go through those pathways to actually get people to sit up and think that it's something that might be of interest and of use to them, and not necessarily banging on our drum, but actually just implementing it within the message that people might be interested in something else. So people are often interested in how to treat certain disease processes. Of course, that's something that is tangibly useful to them. And if we can get a small amount of messaging through that is helpful to people who are treating their patients, then that's hopefully going to be a win for everybody.
Competition for people's attention. It's not an easy race these days, right? To get in front of people and to maintain attention. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I was just going to add, the other thing that we have is we have an online learning program, which is numerous CPD points are available all for free. Very easy win for people who are looking to do CPD. And no matter what your interest is, it's useful. It's done in a way that is engaging, and we're hopeful that, again, if people come across it, that will be something that is of use. I can easily get a couple of CPD points for a couple of hours of online, free online, mooching through something that is actually going to be useful when I'm considering cases in the future.
Where do we find that?
It can be accessed through the AMR Vet Collective website. Or it can be accessed directly through its own website, which is www.vetams.org. Mm-hmm. Okay. So two different ways of getting to the same thing. So.
Okay. I'll put a link to that in the show description.
Fabulous.
In the show notes as well. All right. So the topic that I alluded to before, again, talking about changing mindsets and that, and we discussed when we chatted to you at Vet Expo a year ago, about your work when you were still involved with the students at Wagga?
That you were involved with the
student wellness support, mentorship, and not just clinical teaching as well. Is that right? When you describe position that you held there or how it integrated with your role?
Look, when I first started at Charles Sturt, which was a long time ago now, 14 years ago, after a couple of years, I started getting a little bit disillusioned because we were seeing these absolutely fabulous, vibrant, vivacious kids turn up in first year. They, like we all were at one point in time, absolutely busting to be a vet, so excited, could not think of anything better. And then I'd see them as they go through, and I'd see them turn up in fifth year, and they didn't look the same. They didn't have that level of excitement. And not just about vet, it was about the world. It was like they were a bit beaten. And I thought, surely we can do better than this. Surely we can support these guys to thrive a little bit more throughout their degree, because we all know that finishing the vet degree, it seems at the time like an end point, but really it's the beginning point of the rest of your career. And if you're crawling across that line, it's no good. You really need to be leaping across it and sort of ready to take on the world and be in a really good space. And what you learn at vet school really sets you up in terms of wellness for the rest of your career, because if you can't manage your wellness within vet school, really it's out of the frying pan and into the fire. You're really at a disadvantage moving into the career. So I thought long and hard about it, and I was very lucky enough to work with a fabulous colleague who at the time was working as a research assistant and still does work as a research assistant, but she has fabulous psychology background. And I did an undergraduate degree in Bachelor of Science majoring in psychology before I did veterinary science as well. So I had an interest, and I'm not qualified as a psychologist, that's for certain, but I had an interest in human behaviour. And we got together and thought, look, it would be fabulous if we could set up some sort of program that actually supported the wellness of these fabulous students a little bit better. And I had some conversations with colleagues at different universities and was introduced to a program that was at Vanderbilt University in the US and actually aimed at medical students over there. That was looking at trying to support their medical students better with all of the reasons that I've just discussed. So we developed what we called the Odyssey program, which was basically a program that talked essentially to students around wellness and encouraged them to do three simple things: work hard, play hard, and be kind. And it's as simple as that. We just tried to set up some structures around it. And we essentially, the year that we started, we got very excited, put this program in place, and then realized really quickly that what we were doing was putting a program in that was excellent for middle-aged women, which is what myself and my colleague Lynn were, and pretty useless for anyone who's not a middle-aged woman. We were like, oh, this is going to be awesome. Anyway, the students very quickly kind of were like, yeah, we're not loving this, we're not loving that. And we very quickly realized that what we needed was the students to run it and to have full buy-in. And so we pivoted.
I have to interject here and say, this reminds me of what we just said with the AMR of the, because they don't see the immediate outcome.
Absolutely.
Of it,
yeah.
They're disinterested in it. But the reality is, very soon before they know it, there will be middle-aged women and men.
Yeah.
You might be 24 now, but you just wait. It's coming.
Yeah, exactly. It's nothing you can do to stop it. So, yeah, no, that's exactly right. And it was just that way where you just and also you think it's just a no-brainer to think that we were a little bit simplistic thinking that we were going to be able to do anything. And it's obvious, no matter what you want to change, you need the buy-in of the people who you're trying to help and to give strength to. So anyway, we ended up having this fabulous group of individuals that represented a number of different years that came on board, and we ended up being the facilitators, and they were the ones who said, look, it's this time of year, this is where we're getting issues, I think we should be thinking about supporting our students in this or that way. And a few of the things we did, it ranged from simply holding barbecue breakfasts on the week before exams. We had a cake auction where people made cakes in all disgustingly beautiful forms of veterinary science. So we had kitty litter cakes, we had brain cakes, we had you name it, we had it, dog food cakes. So it's absolutely fabulous. And then we'd auction them off and everyone would eat cake basically and have a fabulous time. We had groups that were intended to cross years, so first year and third year groups where people got to know each other really well in these small group environments. And the idea was that whatever you're going through, whatever pressures you've got in whatever year you're in, so let's say first year when they started, the other people within your cohort have got those same pressures. But if you're engaged with people who are in a year above and they've gone through those pressures, they've come out the other end, they can give you a little bit of insight into it, then that's going to be supportive and helpful, and they can give you some strategies. So, yeah, holistically, we saw a massive change in the way that the students approach things and just the way that the feeling within the vet school over the 5 or so years that it ran really well. There was obviously varied responses to it. And, you know, when you start university, you don't want to be told that you need support. You don't want to be told that you're going into a profession that you need to really think about wellness in. And yeah. So there's always pushback, but it, holistically and in general, it was we saw some fabulous results from it.
It's so tricky what you mentioned there is that balance of, you don't want to be a negative Nelly, and if they're excited and they want to get out into the workforce, and that's great because we want that enthusiasm, because what I'm tired of is a bunch of middle-aged whingers who talk about how much it sucks to be a vet.
Absolutely, yeah.
So we want that enthusiasm, but we also need to be realistic. I had this challenge literally a week or so ago. I was at a small wellness-based event at UQ for the students there, and the job was to go give a motivational talk. And I was like, yeah, totally, I can do that. I can definitely. And when you sit down and funny, the week that I started to write down some ideas I wanted to talk about, I had two scenarios with veterinarians, one 20 years out and one 2-3 years out, having a conversation about how they're struggling. the 20 out one was just talking about burnout. And these are enthusiastic. These are vets I respect. They're not whingers. They are really. And the other one was just saying, it's really hard. She's a senior. She had a job before studying vet for 15 years. And she said, that was just so much easier. Which made me think, how do we approach these students? Because that is the reality. It's going to be friggin' hard. But yet I know lots of people who thrive, lots of people who are happy despite the hard. Did you find ways that worked to, you said the word buy in, or to engage people in and this goes for, I'm asking about student, but the same way happens in practice. You want to create, especially the bigger businesses, you want to create programs. If you have a caring boss and they want to create a wellness program or something like that, but I don't know, people don't want to engage in it.
Look, the best thing that we did was just to act as facilitators, just to open the doors and say, anyone who has an idea, you're welcome to come to us. And we had fabulous ideas, and it hit the spot, and it would hit the spot for different groups at different points in time. So as an example, we had some people come to us saying, we really want to talk about LGBTQI. We want to talk about it. We want to have a talk. And so we set up actually it was a sort of a lunchtime seminar session, and we started off with the LGBTQI chat, and that was fabulous and was just so good for staff and students to come and to listen to issues and to just get a little bit more understanding about what issues were still present and issues that I had no clue were present in a regional environment that aren't necessarily present in a non-regional environment. So that was absolutely mind-blowing. And then we had people who had families who wanted to organise to develop a group with other families. And so we just facilitated it. And then there were these little offshoots where people connected with each other, and then they went on and did their own thing. And we weren't micromanaging it. We were just giving people a voice and giving people the capacity to actually connect with others and to raise their hand and say, okay, I'm struggling here and I need others to talk to about this. So it's all these different kind of areas that came out of the woodwork just because we gave a platform essentially for people to do that. And I think that can be done in practice as well. And the more that people are able to connect, the more protected they are, is the bottom line.
I like what you're saying there. There's a couple of takeaways. And the one that you say there is, when it comes top down, with the best of intentions, right? With we're trying to fix this for you. Because we really care and we want to make it better. But if I think immediately of me and my kids, if I come with an idea, I get eye rolls.
Boring.
And maybe it is a bit like that with students or in a practice or something like that, is to say, well, as soon as it's management or the leadership team that comes and says, hey, here's what we're going to do to fix you or to make things better, then people are like, oh, I'm not interested. But I like that idea of saying, we want to help you, but we're not going to tell you what to do. Here's time and here's money. Do what you want to do. And then the second thing that you said there that actually jumps out to me is that you had very different things for different people. Because that's the other thing. We want to find the solution for the team, for the whole 50 clinics of our corporate group. And that's not the reality, because my struggles are not your struggles.
Yeah.
And also maybe that's an expectation thing from people rolling out programs like this, is you want it to be a massive success. And a massive success is all 200 employees were into it, and they're probably not going to happen. This is a shift for me to go, if 5 people show up and get value from that session, good.
Yep.
The next session,
absolutely,
tick the box for the other 10 people. That's fine.
Absolutely. With an overarching goal. I think as long as people are aware again of that overarching goal, and for us, we tried to make it super simple. Work hard, play hard, be kind. That was it. We figured if people managed to adhere to those 3 things and they had that in the back of their mind and then did all of these other little things that were seen as positive for whatever groups, then we thought that was a win.
Yeah, I want to dig into those 3. So work hard's easy in our profession. That's a given as a student and once you start working. What does play hard look like in this context?
Great question. We had specific ideas about what it looked like, and it was that it was scheduled. Scheduled play, that it wasn't negotiable. It was, if you work hard, you also must play hard. And play looks different to everybody. But we challenged people where we could to connect through play. So we would say things like, if you like running, can you join a running group? If you like knitting, can you join a knitting group? If you're religious, make sure you go to church and connect. What does play look like to you? And when you figure out what you like, then make sure you do it. And independently, as someone who, my door was always open to students, I can't think of a time where a student turned up into my office in tears, and there are a lot of times where they did, that I didn't suggest that they work less and play more. Most of the time it was, well, what are you doing for yourself and how much are you playing? And I don't mean, you know, I would often say, well, you need to watch more Netflix, but don't watch more Netflix in a mindless way. Schedule it in. If you love watching Netflix, don't go your whole time studying, going, oh, I wish I, you know, clicking through different things. Schedule a time and make sure that you do it. You do your 2 hours study, you do your 2 hours Netflix or 1 hour Netflix or whatever it is that you decide you're going to do. Schedule it in, make sure you do it and feel good about it. Don't feel guilty about it. It's actually such a benefit. I was about to say
that's that shift, because very often, and I still find it, I've got a lot of work to do. And then when I do my fun thing, I have this niggly little, using the fun, whatever the fun is, whether it's TV or surfing or something, as an escape. But as you say, it's a guilty escape, so it doesn't actually do me any good versus next week, this time I'm doing this and screw everything else. I'm disconnecting and having fun. Purposefully, mindfully having fun.
Absolutely. It's that mindfulness, isn't it? It's just doing it mindfully.
And then beyond just getting the message out there that you need to remember to have fun. And it's interesting, I listened to a quick little side track to a podcast recently. I forget who it was, but a guy who does happiness research. And that was one of the things. Pleasure was one of the three key pillars of happiness, is that you have to do something pleasurable. There's pleasure and achievement, basically a job well done, and then purpose. But the interesting thing he said about pleasure is it really helps also to stop it from becoming a negative thing, like an addiction, like a Netflix addiction, is to say, when you have pleasure, try and do it with somebody always. And you said it there before, community. You say, well, schedule pleasure and ideally don't do it alone, because then it can become a vice versus an uplifting thing. So when you do your thing, do it in community. I was going to ask you though, so beyond just getting the message out there that you should do that, did you guys track it at all? Was it do you have an outline or a framework where you say, okay, well, show me your hours of fun in the last month?
No, not at all. Just get the message. No. Okay. Yeah, it was just really trying to get the message out. And the difficult thing, I'll tell you, the most difficult thing was making sure that there were role models. That the staff, we're in a university environment. The most difficult thing was actually getting staff on board and making sure that the staff were practicing what we were preaching, because it wasn't necessarily what they were preaching. And sometimes it was in direct contrast to what some of the staff were preaching. And there used to be some feedback that some staff members were like, well, if you've got stuff outside of uni, then you need to get rid of it, because you won't be able to pass this degree without putting absolutely everything into it. So you're working against that kind of traditional view of things, and that was really hard. It was really hard to, and particularly because I'm preclinical epidemiology, which is my area. I'm not in a set of overalls. I'm not at the fun, sexy end of things. So whatever you tell students before they get into those clinical years is often replaced. And that goes for antimicrobial stewardship as well, I must say, but certainly those two things, wellness and antimicrobial stewardship, no matter what you say in the preclinical years, it's what people do in clinical practice that really, really has the impact.
I just pulled up a quote here that I wrote down the other day from a book that says, the immediate influence of behavior is always more effective than that of words. So again, instead of saying that, no, show me how to have a balanced life. And that we are so bad at that in the vet. Or certainly if I think back to my university days or in work days, but at university, our course was all about, they talk about the hidden curriculum.
Yeah,
was,
it used to be. Yeah.
Sacrifice is the key thing that you have to do. Sacrifice your family and your alone time and everything. Yep. That's the only way to be great at this job.
And absolutely. That was what I was taught. Yep. It's
still there.
It's still there. It's still there. And it's so damaging. And it's very hard to change it. Very hard.
And then you wonder why we keep having the same freaking conversations, right? About what's wrong with the vet profession? Why we say the right things, but then we don't do it.
Yeah. And the reality is it is very hard to do. It really is. And it's hard for numerous reasons. I mean, in the university system, it's hard because finances don't support it. It's hard because people have made a life for themselves around it. And then who are you if you're not that person who is sacrificing all the time? You actually have to redefine yourself on a personal, individual level. That's really hard and really confronting. And I think probably it's why our profession will thrive once the new generation comes through and gets to actually be in those positions of influence.
For I'm a second, hopeful. I thought you were going to say once the old guard is all dead.
Oh, no, I would never say that.
So play hard and then be kind. What does that look like? How did you talk about that?
Look, we didn't labour it because I don't think it needs labouring, because it's simple in its simplicity. It's in its words, it's simple and it should be obvious. And we just modelled it and we asked students to think about it when they were giving their feedback. Every student has the opportunity at the end of every session to feedback on their classes to their lecturers. Now, it's an extraordinary privilege to be able to do that. And certainly I didn't when I was an undergraduate. It was not a thing. And the privilege is that there's no feedback that they get. So it's one-way feedback. It's anonymous, and they can say whatever they like. And so as staff members, I've seen some pretty awful feedback. And I don't think that the students, I think probably now they are, but certainly when it all started, I don't think they were aware of the effect and the circular effect that had on their education, because it was pretty extreme. So there were discussions about that and discussions around how their feedback affects and what it might look like and how to create positive change through that feedback process. So that was all around kindness. But that was a specific example. But we run a problem-based learning program within 2 years of our curriculum, and we historically had a lot of group-based issues. Group work, you say group work, anyone who has ever done group work, you sort of break out in a cold sweat when group work is mentioned. So this wasn't specifically a part of the Odyssey program, but it was certainly from the same people who were doing the Odyssey program. We developed a strategy where there was group feedback and discussions around group work. And those discussions were very intentional discussions around why people might not be contributing in the group setting. And historically, people would mark each other on how well they were contributing, and there would be loafers and people who were the wording around people who weren't contributing was always really negative. So we changed that. And we would have this feedback. We would have feedback where people wrote things and submitted them. Then we would have a group conversation, and then we would have a secondary set of feedback. And the way that we framed it was, what's going on for that individual who might not be contributing? Everyone knows it. You know, there's someone who is not doing the work. And it was always, what do you think is going on for that individual? How can we support them? What is it that we can do to actually figure out why they're not contributing, and what can we do to help them? And every single time, there was a really simple explanation and a really simple solution. For example, you've got a group where everyone's had some form of experience with horses, except one member of the group. So you have an equine case. That member is already disadvantaged, and they already feel like they can't contribute, and therefore they have a shame response or some sort of response that makes them not only not contribute but be really quite negative around it. Simple, right? You figure out what's going on, and then they can get support from the other people. They just are able to be vulnerable then and say, oh, actually, I haven't had any experience with horses. And then you can address it. And then all of a sudden, this person is able to contribute, but they're able to contribute in a modified way or a supported way, or they are able to identify what work they need to do to bring themselves up to speed. It worked every single time. And we actually had groups that were absolutely humming by the end of that process because they had just learned how to support each other. So instead of criticizing someone for not contributing, they were asking the question of why might that be and what can we do to support it.
What a extremely valuable lesson. Like you're teaching cognitive empathy. I heard the phrase the other day, empathic imagining.
I like that.
I might not feel what you feel, but I'm going to try and imagine what are you feeling, what's making you behave. Yeah. And what a great lesson for vets, because that's one of my soapboxes, is the clients suck, clients are terrible, stupid people with the stupid animals, which is so damaging to you as a practicing clinician, never mind what it does absolutely. To that relationship. But teaching that approach of, okay, well, what's going on for this person? Why is he being such a knob? Or why are they not giving the medication? It's such a useful skill.
Yep, really good.
I'm interested, you mentioned earlier that there were some, when you guys got these students to structure their own program and bring the issues that they want to address to you, you said there are a few issues that completely surprised you. Can you think of any? Can you remember any that you thought, I didn't even consider this as a problem?
I've mentioned it before, but the one that really stood out was the LBGTQI. Mm-hmm. Or it's just Q now, I think. But that blew my mind because when they came to me, I'm like, yeah, sure, absolutely. But honestly, I was so ignorant that I thought, isn't everyone's accepting these days. I mean, we're in the 2010s. Fine. The information that I heard in that completely changed my view on it. So that was one, which seems, again, my ignorance is on full display there because I was just living in a fantasy land where I thought that everyone was open and communicative and I was wrong. And that was very, very, very informative for me. And then the other thing that I can remember is that one of our students came to us and said, I had a shocker when I started first year. I had no idea what I was doing. I'd really like to put together a little book that is a little book of how to do things for new students. And so we said, fabulous, we'll support that. That sounds great. You know, how hard is it to be in first year and to start university sort of thing, knowing obviously that there are some quite considerable challenges. She went away and she got contributions from a number of people in each different year, made this gorgeous little book, which was, I think she titled Dear Vet Student, Love Vet Student. And it was just gold about all these different things that you wouldn't think about. Don't put a saucepan in a microwave. Who knew? I mean, really, really basic things that all of these different, and it extended from there into a whole load of different things, but just nuggets of gold from students in different years, just stuff that you just completely forget about or don't even consider, that actually they really knock you off your feet when you turn up out of home into a university environment for the first time. And that was just beautiful. I mean, there were so many fabulous examples in that.
Is that book publicly available? I would love to see that. I feel like it should be a resource.
Yeah. I'll dig it up. I will dig it up because we actually printed it out for our students, but I'm sure we've got it online as well.
When we spoke, whether this was off air or on, but you did say that, because it sounds like this role of yours was really fulfilling, but am I right in remembering that you said you also found it personally quite draining? Like it actually took it out of you to the point where you had to step away from it because you became the default counselor and it started. Yeah. Can you tell me about that experience?
So I learned a huge amount from it and I'm still learning from it in retrospect, thinking about how I engaged with it. And I think the first thing to say is that I never offered counseling because I'm not qualified. I was a conduit. So I saw myself as someone who could facilitate people getting the help that they needed and making the decisions that they needed. And my advice was often, do you need to take time out? Do you need to actually take time out from vet school? But as I said, my door was always open. And so I had a lot of people come to me who were struggling and in crisis situations. And subsequent to me being in the role, we actually ended up getting someone who had a dedicated portion of their employment as someone who could take on that role and do it far better than I ever did. But anyway, that I'll come back to that. So I had a lot of students who were turning up in these really difficult, having really difficult situations, and I was trying to help them to navigate through it by finding the support that they need, which we all know there's not enough support out there for people who are in crisis situations. And I didn't have enough boundaries in place. I think I can say that now. And I wasn't aware of what I was taking on at the time. And I had a family in a situation where I had a teenage daughter, which is always challenging. Anyone who's ever had a teenage daughter will know that it's challenging, but it's also confronting insofar as very important that issues aren't brought into the home that you can't manage. And for me, there were some really severe issues that our poor students were dealing with some really horrendously poor outcomes, unfortunately. And I found it very difficult to keep that out of my home environment. And I found it very difficult to engage in it without getting too involved. Like I said, these were my issues and my boundaries that I hadn't put in place well enough. I had varied support from the university, but universities they struggle, and they struggle to understand. And I'm not talking about the school, I'm talking the university in general, struggle to understand the extent of issues that veterinarians and veterinary students face. And so I didn't really have the support that I needed, and I didn't feel like I could advocate for that support, which again, that's an issue with me. I should have been able to do that. I should have felt like I was able to do that. And I ended up actually burning out completely. So I dropped back. I actually put my resignation in, but to the credit of my head of school at the time, he said, well, let's talk through this. What can we do? So I ended up going down to 2 days a week, and I started a business for the other 3 days a week, which it was a fabulous outcome in the end. But it took me about 2 years to recover from that. It was a really, really bad time for me, and I felt extremely guilty for burning out and for leaving, because I felt like I was really letting down a huge number of people in many different ways. And again, that's probably perception potentially rather than the reality that I can see now. But, you know, again, a really good example of what you said before about that sacrifice and that mentality that we often have as veterinarians, where it is about self-sacrifice, which it absolutely should never be. And so I think I learned a lot. I know I learned a lot from that about me, about how I engage with things, and also about the profession, because once you're a vet, you're always a vet. And even though I wasn't working in a clinical role, I still had that mindset that you described really well, that I think really is very hard to get out of in some situations. And then I applied it to this different scenario and really kind of sunk myself with it. The positive thing about it is, as I stepped out, we did manage to get some funding. We'd always struggled with funding for a dedicated individual who is there then 1 day a week to essentially triage students who were struggling and to understand how to help them. And that was absolutely fabulous. We lost that funding, which was a really negative thing, but we've just applied for it again, and we've got some really great support, and we're hoping to get it all back online again. So from a personal perspective, it was a really hard time, but immense time of growth and learning for myself. And certainly if I was to go back and do it again, I'd do it in a very different way. And I feel like I've gained some real perspective on what we can offer and what we should be offering our students and our graduates in this space without sinking ourselves in the process.
Yeah. So you would have done it differently. How? Like, let's say somebody is in a mentor position or something where they are confronted with these situations, and it's sometimes as simple as just a senior student or somebody empathetic.
Yeah.
But you have these people who draw people there, right? People come and offload on them. How would you do it differently?
Yeah, I would be intentional about my boundaries. I would sit down and think about it, and I would identify what I needed. I would identify how I was going to get it. And I would identify support. And that support for me would look very different to just being going home and talking about it, or phoning a friend and talking about it, or talking about it to a colleague. It would be actual proper support. It would be scheduling in times to speak to someone, and whether that's through the IEP program, I think that's what it's called, the external counselling program that we have through the university, or whether it's through a different mechanism, it would be an intentional situation where I could actually speak to someone who has training and background in debriefing and communicating around this, because it's impossible to hold. You cannot hold it, and you should never have to hold it. And this is the other thing that I've tried to do. Don't know if it's with great effect, but I think really demystifying that communication around counselling and support, it's essential. It's absolutely essential. Doing the work on yourself and having someone to talk to who can reflect difficult things in your life back to you is absolutely essential, and particularly if you're in a supportive role of someone else, or if you're in a role that, whether you've chosen to or not, if you're in a role where other people are coming to you, and that you are not necessarily providing them with counselling, but you are just within their orbit and needing to engage.
That's super useful. I'm fascinated by the sentence you said earlier. I felt so guilty about burning out, which is almost funny. It's so sad.
Yeah, isn't it?
Oh, I'm on fire. I'm so sorry that I'm on fire.
Yeah. I hope I don't spit an ember onto you. Sorry.
Yeah. I don't know if it's time to even dig into the psychology of that, but the whole burnout talk, that could be a whole separate podcast episode, but I've never heard anybody say that I felt guilty about burning out, but I can see that, because you're feeling like a failure in it, right?
Oh, complete failure. And no idea why, and no idea what you need to do about it. And it's extraordinary, actually. And I think normalizing conversations around that as well are really important, and understand. And I can say, I don't know what would have happened to me if I didn't step out. And I'm so grateful for having done that. And I just hope that other people, I mean, it felt like such a failing at the time, but it's just not. And we need to pivot so that we don't see it as a failing. And I've been talking about, well before I burnt out, I've been talking to students about it for years and years and years, saying, you need to step out, have a year off and come back. You need to thrive. This is what you need to do. But when it's you, or when it's in a slightly different setting or scenario, you know, we just need to normalize it. It's not failure. It's essential, and it can take a long time to recover. And I will say, I said 2 years, and I think easily 2 years for me to feel like I had some semblance of recovery. And that's a really long time. And I think people need to know it does. When you get to that level, when you're that low, which there'd be plenty of people out in our profession who are, it's okay to take the time. It's just trying to figure out how to do it and to get support to do it.
I remember I think it was with Rhonda Andrews, we talked about burnout, and when she described the difference between just being fatigued, I'm just tired and a bit run down and burnt out. I used the example of a car running out of fuel, which is that, well, I need to just get some fuel. Stop, take a pause, fill up, and off I go again, versus the engine's burnt out. You're going to have to tow it in. It's going to be at the shop for a long time. You're going to have a complete rebuild before you can hit the road again.
And the other thing is, when you're in it, you don't know if you're ever going to be able to be rebuilt. That's the thing that's really scary. That's what I found really scary. You don't know. You don't know whether that's it, whether you're done.
Well,
you're toast.
Rebuilding the exact same engine and then taking it back and doing the exact same stuff with that same engine again is folly, right? It's just something's got to be 100%. Different, because that why did it happen in the first place?
I think getting support for that and understanding about that is essential. And there's so many fabulous things in the public domain now. The Nagoski twins have that fabulous resource and book around burnout, and have spoken about it just so well. If anyone's experiencing it, I would highly recommend that they engage with that as a start. They just explain it in a way that is just so tangible and so easy to grab onto and to feel. I think dig into it. Don't shy away from it, because you can't outrun it. That's for sure. It's not possible.
Last time we talked about Ted Lasso.
Oh, I love Ted.
I usually ask people about their favorite podcasts that they listen to, but you and me have talked about Ted Lasso in the past. Can we talk about Ted Lasso? Is there anything for anybody who hasn't watched it yet, which I don't know if there's anybody out there, what is it and why did you love it and what did you take from it?
Oh, Ted, righto. Do you know, I haven't watched it. The last time we spoke, it must have been the last episode.
I hadn't watched the last episode and you had.
Yeah. And I was loving it. Anyway, I haven't actually, I'm going to have to go back and start again from the beginning. That's a good reminder. I'm going to watch it again. But Ted Lasso, so it's about a British football team who gets a new coach from the US who has had no experience of football, of British football, but has experience of American football. Yeah. Of soccer, that's right. He hasn't had any soccer experience. So he just has this beautiful view on life and this beautiful way of engaging with the team and the individuals within the team and the management of that team. And it's just, how do you explain it? It's just life affirming. It makes you think, it makes you reflect, it makes you open your heart to all of the issues that they're going through. And it just is all about teamwork and support and digging into the tricky bits of life, I think, probably. How would you explain it?
It's interesting. When listening to you trying to explain it, I think the reason it resonates with you is it's because it is about work hard, play hard, be kind. That's what the series is about.
Yeah, you're right.
It's funny you said about rewatching it. When I traveled recently and they had a couple of episodes, the first couple of episodes was on the in-flight entertainment. I was like, well, let me watch it again. The first series is a masterclass in leadership. So it's a cool story and it's funny and it's all these things. But and I actually started writing on the plane and now we're going to have to finish it. I started writing an essay about leadership lessons from series one of Ted Lasso. And then I think series two is about personal development. Because then he goes through a rough time. Ted kind of burns out, doesn't he? So yeah, just a leadership, teamwork, and a lesson in work hard, play hard, and be kind.
Nice. And Rebecca.
Rebecca,
I'd like to be like Rebecca. I'm just going to put that. I'm not quite so mean. She's mean at times. I don't like that about her. But yes, she's fabulous.
Who wouldn't?
Female role models there.
Absolutely. All right, Jane, let's wrap it up with is there anything else that I've missed out on? We've had so many discussions, I forget that what we haven't covered. Is there anything on your heart that you'd like to get out there?
No, I don't think so. I don't think about
antibiotics. Don't just prescribe antibiotics, fools.
Yeah. Yes, take home message. Think about your antimicrobial stewardship. That's right.
Okay, so your one lesson to all the veterinary new grads of 2023, a little bit of advice for their life around their vet degree.
Yeah, okay. I've got a head start in this because I usually am the person who's standing up the front of the dinner for our vet students when they finish their final year. So I have had the opportunity to think about this before. Two things. Number one, fail. Make sure you fail. Make sure you can fail. Make sure you are able to deal with failure in a really positive way. Know that you will fail. Understand that it's a part of life, and if you haven't managed to fail yet, make sure you do manage to fail and figure out what it takes for you to fail well and to learn from it. That's super important. And number two, define what you want your life to be like. Sit down and think about it. The non-negotiables and the negotiables, and then anything that's non-negotiable, make sure you don't lose that. So whether it be friends, family, support, sport, whatever it looks like to you, whatever life looks like to you is important, make sure that that is something that you can manage in whatever job that you have. And if you have a job that you can't manage it in, then you need to reassess. That would be my two main things that I would impart.
I like that last one. I feel like, and people often ask me, because I've often said on the podcast, I didn't enjoy my vet career for at least the first 10 years. And I think probably that was the thing that changed was exactly that. The first 10 years was just, I'm in this current and being dragged along. and I don't like it. But I had no idea of, well, what else then? So if not this, then what should it look like? And it was only when I started thinking, okay, well, what do I want? I know what I don't want, but what do I want? And then how do you make it happen? It's such a critical lesson.
Yeah. I think there would be so many people like that. I feel exactly the same way. You know, unless you're challenged to stop and think about it, you just don't.
Mm. And then regular review, right? To say, well, I said absolutely. I wanted this and I've started moving towards it and now it's another 5 years and, hey, hang on, I'm not doing that thing that I said I want to do.
Yep.
Pivot again, change it again.
Yeah. Get someone to hold you to account yearly.
Jane, thank you so much for making the time again for round three. I can't wait to get this out here finally, out to the world. And good luck with the antibiotic microbial stuff. I think in the previous episodes, I'll put all the links to all of them. If there's any new sites or new resources, please send those to me and I'll make sure that they're in the show description, the show notes. Make sure we get that message out in front of people. But thank you for everything that you do, both with antibiotics and the life skills.
Oh, thanks, Stu. It's been great chatting to you.